In that famous story from the eighth chapter of John's Gospel, when Jesus bends down to write upon the ground with the woman caught in adultery standing there, with the authorities standing there, waiting for words to tumble him into their trap, he brings to mind a little phrase from a present-day leadership guru concerning tight conflicts that leaders get into inevitably. Ron Heifetz counsels, get up into the balcony. Now, don't everybody all go up there right all at once, but get into the balcony. Now, it may be that this counsel is as plain as telling parents to count to 10 before they react to their child's tantrum. But looking at it a little more subtly, get into the balcony means don't engage with conflict at the level that it's coming at you. Don't get involved at that level. Aim to see more than you have seen. Aim to see more than they see who bring the conflict. See it from a distance. Get into the balcony. Or, in Jesus' case, bend down and write on the ground. Throughout this electoral season, the national electoral season, we here at the Riverside Church have been aiming to get some distance on issues that are vexing polarized blocks of Americans, unable to imagine justice together, to act accordingly. Christians, however, are called to be peacemakers, not polarizers, and so we've been striving for depth in our vision. Here's a little thing. Depth of vision, depth of field, the kind of thing they want to make sure you have when you go for a driver's license test still. Depth of vision, this is just a physical fact, comes from seeing from two different points of view. That's what three dimensions are about. Getting depth of vision requires more than one point of view. Has to be. And so we're asking questions that can deepen us and help us see those whom we oppose. Can we understand something in the values of others? Can understanding drive us deeper into self consciousness, self-awareness? Can new insights reveal some new horizon for action? These kinds of questions. Well, if this is possible, then our passions are not our first friends. Not at all. Like Jesus bending down and writing something on the ground, we sometimes need to disengage from the emotions that are pouring through our own structures of self-protection, our egos. And if what I'm saying makes sense to you, you recognize that I'm talking about fruits of the Spirit: love, joy, peace, patience, gentleness, generosity, self-control. Fruits of the Spirit are the sign that a spiritual life is spiritual, that there is some real freedom, some play, if you will, some ability to pull back from reaction in order, from a distance, to choose what action will follow. Today, we're going to think through abortion. As we get nearer to the election, the topics get tougher. In this matter, the wings of our citizenry, right and left, seem hardly attached to the same bird. You know, our praying for the wings of a dove, a new way of seeing and of progressing, our praying must never amount to muddling toward the middle, unwilling to take a stand. And yet, we can bend down and draw out some real thought. We'll try that today again. Consider Isaiah. Whatever else a dream of the end times is, it's from a distance, yes? There, Isaiah dreams in chapter 11 of that day when the Lord's true servant will rule a peaceable kingdom, so beautifully read moments ago. Now, his oracle certainly does not touch directly on our subject. In fact, the Bible has absolutely no word directly on the subject of whether or not to abort a fetus. However, the peaceable kingdom certainly has implications for peace between the genders and peace within ourselves, a peace for men and for women, such as our present kingdoms certainly do not give. Obviously, that little child who shall lead them, whether nursing as in one verse or weaned as in another, has come from a peaceable mother in the image of the prophet. Moreover, as the eye of the poet sweeps gently over the young of various beasts, certainly the engendering of those new creatures comes not out of sexual struggle, but out of a peace among all creatures in the vision of the prophet. Now, the prophet does not say anything about how there shall be peace between men and women. He seems to assume it, and that fact may only show that the men had all the power, at least the power to speak aloud, and to write, and to be in the public square. But still, consider for a moment. Suppose Isaiah's dream were extended just a little bit beyond the call to the calf and the bear to lie down, and quite apart from any invitation that man and woman should lie down, which they seem not to need. What if the oracle said that the daughters and sons of all generations would stand up together? Wouldn't that dream fit the spirit of the whole peaceable kingdom? And so, in some way, it is our dream, for we have experienced a great struggle between men and women in a whole new way in the last half century or so. And so we are pressing on to imagine, as if in the spirit of Isaiah, from a distance, the justice that we can make when all sons and daughters might stand up together. But now, here is Jesus, confronted in the temple courtyard by religious authorities holding a woman caught in adultery, and suddenly we are back in our ordinary bed. The dream is over. This is a world we recognize where women are in trouble for sexual behavior which does not trouble men at all. How can we understand this old, old story, which is by no means yet done? Of course, you work at this yourselves. I'm not going to give you the answer, but together, let's look at it from a distance. We humans, with this DNA, able to make this shaped body, we've been around for 1 or 2 million years. You know, we're not doing real well. We've been around that long and we've arrived at this? Actually, it's only been about 30,000 years that we've even formed ourselves into groups with intentions and families to grow one another. And about 5,000 years ago, we finally learned to hitch a plow to a draft animal, and we became real farmers. Just yesterday, real farmers were able to sustain sizable populations with the food that was grown. Civilization could get going then, and only then, once the animal had been hitched to a plow. Civilization was dependent on that technology. And that technology was dependent on the greater physical strength of men to drive the teams of beasts that pulled the plows, that made the grain, that fed the people. Here's a fact. Everywhere on Earth where large populations developed through agriculture, men controlled the public sphere. Women controlled the private and interior sphere. This kind of research is gathered by many, many students of the disciplines. Frankly, biology was destiny. It was a division of labor. To consider it oppressive is just silly. It's importing a modern-day construct on thousands of years by means of which we would not be here had they not been as they were. Let it go. Women were not duped. Men were not pigs. It was a division of labor appropriate to their time. But then, as we have said in a recent sermon here, in the 1700s, history began. Societal change erupted across the Western nations as minds devised new machines exceedingly more powerful than any male on Earth anywhere. In fact, any woman could run these same machines, though for a very long time, the men wouldn't share their toys. So, seen from a distance, all of this happened in an evolutionary blink of an eye. It was just yesterday. It was just yesterday. A man's excess physical strength to no longer determines anything about his authority to be in the public square, to be asserting control, unless through threats and coercion, which the society itself does not approve. Today, mind does stand over matter. Of course, mind depends on matter and on biology, but it really has transcended and included all that came before. Biology is no longer destiny. Society has thus been developing new challenges for individuals, new kinds of inner growth. And a woman now enters the public sphere in principle as an equal. I'm not saying all the work is done, but in principle, a woman enters the public sphere as an agent. There is no longer this clear separation of the bodied sphere and the sphere of the mind. A man, by contrast, is called to deepen his inner awareness, to become more connected with his family, as also with his feminine nature, as we're told. And so very many of us think all this change is normative and good. But seen from a distance, it all began 6 or 8 or 10 generations ago. We have to have compassion on our forebears, as well as those who are bearing these burdens now and struggling with them. For many people, both men and women, are shocked to be pushed from the predictable duties of their biological nature and its ancient social structures, pushed into the light of conscious choice, where every man and every woman is equal in power to decide who they are, how to lay life plans, whom to serve, whom not to serve. I think there need be no question in our minds as to why reproductive health, as it's called so often, and the politics of abortion, no question need remain in our minds as to why these are so fraught with anger and misunderstanding. It is because, as a species, we are just now waking up to what it means that all of us, personally, must decide the meaning of our body. It's not given. It's not at all given. Biology is not destiny. This doesn't mean that the leading edge of awakening conscience and consciousness belongs to the left wing, that they get all the policies right, and that the right gets all the policies wrong. It's not that simple. Rather, let us simply accept that in some measure, profound spiritual struggles to discover our nature before our Creator always are expressed politically as well. That's how close spirit and politics are. The joined body of humans seeking to discover what it is that God is calling from us in our duties to one another and to our Creator are always having to work out differences in consciousness through politics, partly. The new requirements of selfhood cause us to try unexplored territory, to make mistakes, to feel the constraints of power blocks, legal and sometimes just moral, as the established forms of power resist the expression of freedom on the part of those who did not have it formerly. This is why politics belongs in the pulpit. It's how we get on with understanding the call to justice. It's part of how we get on. This is, after all, how right and left contest for the future. See it from a distance. And then, straighten up and address the particular case. Those who want to make abortion illegal are channeling a value that has served humanity well for millennia. It's a very straightforward value: to protect what is vulnerable and valuable. They're channeling that. They're holding on to that as an order of value against which no other may be brought. A sign that this is, in fact, the basic value which those who oppose abortion, the basic value they are in touch with, comes when you ask a question of the anti-abortion partisan. You say, "Do you mean to put these women in jail for seeking an abortion? Do you mean to separate them from their other children to punish them? I've asked this question scores of times, and every single time, the person backs away, said, no, I want to put the doctors in jail, but I don't want to hurt the women. I want them home where they belong. And so you can feel a core value at work. Now, if that response angers you and you want to do something about it, well, back off. See it from a distance, like Jesus confronting the authorities. You know, his concern in that story is not alone for the woman whom only he sees. They don't see the woman at all. They don't care about her at all. They only want to test him. But his concern is for the woman to see her truly. Isaiah's prophecy was, there would come the righteous servant who would not judge with what the eye sees or what the ear hears. Jesus sees her truly, but he also wants to reach the men who are blinded by their intentions. How can we bend down and disengage from the violent plans of the blind in order to re-engage them in a surprising way, in a way that might help someone to see what we who hold to the value of choice affirm? For in the question of abortion, there is something else that is vulnerable and valuable. That is the rising consciousness of women, and of any particular woman who seeks to be regarded as a full moral agent in her own nature, in her own identity, not just regarded, but seeks to act as a full moral agent. This is vulnerable. This is precious. This is valuable. This is new on the face of the earth in terms of the society generally. For the woman was not to emerge until 300 years ago or less from the private sphere into the public. This phenomenon is embryonic. It is vulnerable when viewed from the distance of social history. In her definitive work on the ethics of abortion, Dr. Beverly Harrison, formerly of the faculty of Union Theological Seminary, she wrote about this vulnerable, valuable thing I'm talking about from the first few pages of the book called Our Right to Choose. I read, "The contention that women as a group ought to have the same basic standing as rational moral agents as do men, with all the rights and responsibilities attendant to that status, has deep implications for theology and ethics. Discounting women's standing as moral agents has been not only an historical, logical, and theological error, but also a moral failing. From the standpoint of women's experience, a basic moral question is operating. What am I to do about the procreative power that is mine by virtue of being born female? The question of abortion arises only in this wider human context. The habits of discussing abortion as if it were a discrete deed is a way of formulating the abortion issue as a moral question abstracted out of and irrelevant to the way it arises in women's lives." Beverly Harrison. Now, one can understand the desire to protect the vulnerable unborn life in a woman so very easily. Honestly, every parent awaiting a child understands this ancient value implicitly. However, the agency of a woman, her freedom to determine who she is and how she'll plan her life without fear of legally sanctioned intrusion upon her body, this is also a vulnerable reality which has only stood upon the earth these few generations. If, by law, a society decides that the moral consciousness of women shall not be free to choose, that they shall submit to biological processes that they do not want to submit to, then society itself comes to a moral halt. Men and women alike will remain bound to their biologically defined fears and structures. Harrison, a little bit more. Harrison speaks of a society so bound. A society which would deny the conditions of procreative choice to women, or which treats women merely as reproductive means to some purported end of that society's need to self-perpetuate, is a society that mandates women's inferior status as less than full rational beings, denying them full claim to intrinsic value in the process. Likewise, a society that incorporates a durable structure of coercion, even violence, against women as morally appropriate to its functioning, and yet claims that it upholds the sanctity and respect for human life, is deluded. Where does this leave us? From a distance, can you dream a world where there is no need for abortion? Where abortion is rarer and rarer? Do you want to dream such a world? Do you want to get there? Many who oppose abortion rights do not know, or do not seem to know, that most of us share the same dream, that it would be the extraordinarily right goal for a society so to configure and construct itself as, among other goods, to have abortion safe and rare and legal. The political question on which we have such a fundamental disagreement today is this: which means toward that dream is more likely to get us on the way to a society more and more resembling one in which they will not hurt or destroy on all my holy mountain? For the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as waters cover the sea. How do we get there? Can laws punishing women, and by the way, only women, for desiring to plan their lives without bodily invasion, can laws bring about that vision? The answer is in Isaiah's dream. He says that the earth shall be full of the knowledge of God. Not the earth shall be full of the laws and the prisons of God, but the earth shall be full of the knowledge of God as the waters cover the sea. Knowledge, conscience, not law and obedience, which are much lower. Laws must serve the development of conscience. Laws must give way where there is evidence that conscience can grow. The laws and policies of the state have a lot to do with how this unfolds. But it does not develop in a moral cage or a metal cage. If pro-life advocates, including the Roman Catholic Church and the evangelical churches, and frankly any church, if pro-life advocates were to drop their unholy alliance with state sanctions, state power, state threats, if they stopped threatening to punish women and their doctors who are seeking abortion as a solution to their conflicted situations, if they gave themselves instead to life-giving goals that support the strengthening of societies, of communities, of education, of pregnant women, for that matter, well, how much stronger we would be if the weapon were dropped by all those who advocate the value, the beautiful value of the unborn. Drop the weapon of punishment and use the tongue of wisdom. Dream. That is the invitation of the scriptures. From a distance, we can see that abortion is not just a discreet appointment in an antiseptic clinic. Abortion is about broken promises, unwanted relationships, domestic abuse, poverty, lack of education, distorted economies, and, of course, possibilities for growth and development. All these things, just what the church is called into being by our Lord to show and to be and to do. The spirit, I think, the spirit of Jesus' attention given to the woman caught in adultery can for us be a guide into all that must happen in the generations to come. For Jesus sees her. No others see her as human. She's just a means to an end. And Jesus straightens up at length and he asks her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No, sir. Neither do I condemn you." Jesus desires her being, her growth, her development. Why? Because like all human beings, she is an end in herself. That's the phrase you could walk from here with. All human beings are ends in themselves. And in that spirit, we can support safe and legal abortion as essential to the present moral development of the whole society. But I leave you with this. From a distance, we can also see that legal abortion is only a step on a path toward the peaceable kingdom. It is a means of bending down and writing on the ground for a while, long enough to let deeper voices of life arise from within the human community until that day when they shall not hurt or destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as waters cover the sea. Amen.